have Dr. Galloway agree to that.
I have been asked by Allenby Farms Limited to prepare evidence in relation to the recreation amenities available on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. This includes assessing recreation amenity values associated with Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, describing benefits to the district and water community from Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron trails, recommending matters to be included in a recreation management plan for Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron form a central geographic feature within the Wanaka Township with existing recreation amenities that receive high use from local residents, regional visitors, and tourists. Formalization of the proposed tracks on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron to significantly enhance the recreation amenity values by providing additional access in the case of both Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, concentrating overall use. In addition, these trails provide additional linkages with the larger recreation network in Wanaka. From a recreation perspective, the development of the additional house sites by Allenby Farms would have no effect on current or future amenities so long as access was assured. A range of benefits accrued to the district and Wanaka communities from access to Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, and these can be broadly grouped into areas of personal use and quality of life, economic and environmental benefits. As I state in my primary evidence, the trails receive a lot of use from residents, and there's ample evidence that they are popular with visitors as well. The economic benefits accrued from the Mount Iron, from the attention Mount Iron receives from the tourism industry and visitors, as well as the values estate agents as Wanaka and Wanaka place on the views of Mount Iron and or its proximity to its trails. It is clear from my research and evidence of the experience of the resource that Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron make living in and visiting Wanaka more desirable. Wanaka benefits from the de facto and incomplete trail network. The Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron resource sits in the rough middle of an existing collection of trails. And these are all illustrated on the recreation, Wanaka recreation map that Mr. Goldsmith passed out earlier. These trails have developed separately over time and in some cases lack coherent linkages, and in others, residential use has created a network used to commute and access disparate tracks. Formalization of the proposed trails and access on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron would contribute significantly to the completion of this network. Given the historic recreation use of Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron and the growth of tourism and recreation and commercial development within the eastern part of Wanaka, it is apparent that the use of and desire for access to Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron will increase in proportion. The existing recreation research on which the benefits available on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron are based will face increasing pressure from traffic and unmanaged access. The Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron resource currently exists as a highly used, multiple-use recreation area with significant recreation and natural amenity values and is located in the midst of considerable residential development and tourism focus. Conflict between recreation activities, i.e. mountain biking and foot traffic, management frameworks and decisions, i.e. whether mountain biking, rock climbing, etc. are permitted on the resource, and between recreation and environmental amenities, i.e. impacts to sensitive vegetation from foot traffic, will occur and likely has occurred. In addition, there are questions of health and safety and liability which are currently in question. As much of the recurrent recreation value on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron depends on informal access to and use of private land by the general public, there is no guarantee that this access will continue to be available. The proposed trail easement served to formalize trails on Mount Iron and add access to Little Mount Iron and go some way to developing a commuter link to the town center along the base of Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. As such, they add considerable value to the recreation amenities already in existence to help protect the environmental values of the SNA and create additional recreation amenities on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. The most appropriate and advantageous solution to protect the recreation and environmental amenities which currently exist, as well as those that may be developed, would be the development of a recreation resource management plan. This plan would be developed by the private landowner in consultation with and probably the agreement of DOC, catalog the environmental recreation and other amenities of Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, formalize a flexible decision-making framework for managing existing and future recreation use, establish methods for establishing permitted use and impacts and review of permitted uses, for example, mountain biking, establish methods for consideration of new activities and amenities, anticipate negotiating agreements for user-managed development and use of particular assets, for example, the rock climbing, address management of environmental impacts, recreation, invasive species, etc., and address the maintenance and development of tracks to a particular trail standard or overarching management strategy, for example.
Thank you, Dr. Galloway. You just asked another question that I remain unclear about. Now, clearly, Mount Iron is a significant recreational resource in town. What I don't get a sense of from your evidence, and maybe I just need to read it more carefully, but tell me anyway, is what is the incremental benefit of expanding out from the existing legal trails to the trails and easements that are now being proffered? Like, put aside the extent to which informal use is being made, because as you've observed, that could stop at any time. But the public have a right to go on the legalised trails. What's the incremental benefit of access to the other trails that are being proffered?
Well, two main things come to mind. The first would be that those informal trails are being used and they access different aspects of the community surrounding Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. So access through to from Hidden Hills or the trail that goes along the base of Mount Iron that currently is stopped by a fence could continue on as proposed and provide a route that eventually goes all the way around to Hidden Hills Road from The second aspect that comes to mind is that given that these trails are being used, and it's not just the proposed trails that are being used, there are lots of volunteer trails that happen. Even off the formal easements, there are segments where people have sort of created their own access points to views. And the trails that people follow, and some of this is going to include mountain biking, meander on and off the proposed trails. So the one incremental benefit would be consolidating their use, so that the impacts of the wider resource are minimized by the high levels of traffic that are there now and will likely increase in the future.
And what's your view about mountain bikers? Fans or encouragement?
I am a mountain biker. I think that there's a real potential for a disaster with shared use trails on a steep resource such as Mount Iron. In addition, the soils are fragile. So if a mountain bike, and this would come under the auspices of a management plan, in my view, if a group were to put their hand up to develop appropriate trails, which would be easy to maintain at low cost, that were separate from the existing walking tracks at some point in the future, then I see no reason why those two activities couldn't coexist. And they're like mountain biking.
But until then, they shouldn't.
Well, it's difficult. There are some real health and safety issues currently. A mountain biker coming down one of those tracks at 30 k's an hour coming into the bay stroller, which happens all the time, I'm sure, at lots of locations where there's shared use of trails, it's not a good situation. The media is full of examples where residents who want to use the trails for walking their dog, for example, are coming into conflict with mountain bikers who are trying to use the trails for their purposes, which don't coexist nicely in that situation.
Question on the right. Ms. Hanson.
Dr. Galloway, very interesting figures about the visitor numbers. What I wanted to clarify with you is in paragraph 9 in statement P as well, paragraph 9 of your evidence in chief, that is, what did you mean when you said that the development of the additional house sites would have no effect on current or future amenities? What are you talking about when you're referring to amenities?
From the recreation amenity, that's the scope of my evidence. So as you're walking up from Hidden Hills, you're not going to experience those houses any more than you would experience the existing houses, from my view, as I've envisioned it.
Okay.
Coming down the trail, the same would be true. So
what you're saying is, as a recreational user, your experience of being on Mount Iron was not changed by additional houses. Okay. Thank you for that. And now, in evidence in chief, which is where I marked up where my questions would be, in paragraph 11, you said that from your research, Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron made living in and visiting Wanaka more desirable. And I'd just like you to kind of expand on that a little bit. How you see the recreational opportunity of Mount Iron impacting on visitors to Wanaka?
Well, it figures highly on sites like TripAdvisor. It's the one, I don't remember the exact position.
Well, I did read that. You said, yeah. I think number 3.
So it's broadcast widely as one of the things to do in Wanaka. So, and that the economic impact flow from how long someone stays here. So by giving them a day on Mount Wanaka or on Mount Iron, for example, they've spent more time here and will likely spend more money here. So that's one aspect of it. Another way you can consider it is to think about if Mount Iron weren't there, if that Rishi Mutong didn't exist, you'd have a glacial plain that wouldn't provide rock climbing opportunities, or vistas. I described in my evidence in chief how I saw walking around Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron and the high alpine experience that you feel, even though you're right in the middle of a well-developed plain, and the fact that you're surrounded by Kanika with views to the mountains in the distant background. So there's that remote sense, there's the view at the top, there's the ease of access to do that for people of all, well, not all abilities, but considerable range of abilities. It provides commuting access, which often isn't in train with recreation, but it does contribute to quality of life. So being able to ride your bike into Wanaka without having to drive a car or look for a place to park, once you do those kinds of things. There's activities that are growing or that exist there and aren't formalized anywhere. People launch hang gliders in specific winds. And those things are fine, but they're not managed currently. Even the walking access isn't open slather. As many people can go up there as can go up there, and that's fine. But as I noted in my walking up my site visit around Little Mount Iron, the rock climbing sites have expanded away from the central piece at the Old Sailors Road there, and are now in evidence, both in terms of existing bolted routes and routes in development higher up on those, as Dr. Lloyd pointed out, sensitive rock outcrops. So, there's a fair bit of opportunity there, but if it's allowed to continue sort of unchecked, then there will be downstream effects from that.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned that people coming to Wanaka would, because of Mount Owen, they would stay an extra day.
Essentially, yeah.
Is that based on your analysis of how people that come to Wanaka spend their recreational time and how long they spend here?
In 2016, there were 130,000 trips up Mount
Iron
by DOCS counts, and I did check on the reliability and validity of those and of those track figures, and they seem to bear out in terms of how they're actually counting the visitors. So that's a considerable number of people who live here. So I would think that that's pretty direct evidence that a lot of people come here and visit Mount Iron to walk up and.
Okay, I accept that, but what I perhaps need to ask the question the other way around, and you touched on it, if there was no Mount Iron, would that stop people from coming to Wanaka and spending the same amount of time here as they currently do?
Well, perhaps that argument's mistaken, because it is impossible to argue a negative, but I can't imagine people wouldn't come to Wanaka. But if they did come to Wanaka and Mount Iron weren't there, they wouldn't be able to experience it. So it seems reasonable. Yeah, but they'd spend less time here. Time spent here on Mount Wanaka wouldn't exist.
Well, what is your understanding of the recreational opportunities around Wanaka?
Pretty substantial. I've spent a fair bit of time traveling around the place, on the lake, from the trails.
And you don't think that they would choose somewhere else to go and walk for the day, like Rocket.
They may well, but they wouldn't be able to experience Mount Iron.
Well, you've answered the question that I was intrigued by that, and so I think I understand you to say that the significant visitor numbers are a confirmation that it is an important visitor attraction and for local people as well.
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just strangely enough to do with bikes and cycling on my own time. You mentioned shared use raises issues, and that's 100% true. But that would be true of just about any track that you ride on, would it not? So, are there any examples of the Nirvana that you've described, which is appropriate trails, easy to maintain, shared blissfully, and separate? Where people are operating separate from each other.
Sure, there are the Queenstown Trails Trust operates a large network of trails that are shared use, and offshoots from that trail include the trails on Mount Edmunds, Skyline Gondola Trails. The trails around Coronet Peak, where it's skiing and mountain biking, those two things are seasonally opposed, usually. There are trails around Arrowtown that are...
I'm actually probably not going to pick any holders.
Yeah, no, there's heaps.
I do agree.
My answer.
The one point is, though, that it seems to be a recurring theme with trails, is that and it was suggested by Mr. Goldsmith, that once they're created, that's the hard bit done, but the general experience with most people who are involved in tracks and trails is that the burden of maintaining what is an ever-increasing series of trails is actually quite hard to do. The cost.
Well, so if they're designed properly, and there are, again, let's go back to the Trails Trust in Queenstown, there were trails that weren't designed to a standard that when they later collapsed or washed out, did so at a considerable expense to the ratepayers to have them fixed. So if those had been designed appropriately and built appropriately, then that cost wouldn't be there. And it applies to walking trails and biking trails, I think, equally, in places where it's difficult. And I don't know if you've experienced the entirety of the Mount Iron Loop, but at one point there's
several times, almost weekly.
There's a set of stairs at one point, and that site hardening provides for ease of access, but it also helps protect the sensitive, the friable rock base behind it, so that that access doesn't get any worse and people don't fall and hurt themselves. And just down from that, there's a switchback, which is pretty heavily eroded. And I would put forward that that switchback wasn't well designed in the first place, so it wouldn't have eroded. So there's been a lot learned about trail building and how to minimize maintenance down the track.
You have to say though that switchback is there's not a lot of alternative ways down really at that point.
I think it's about runoff.
Yeah.
Less water erosion.
Yeah. The and
sorry, what if I make one comment just to make sure there's not a misunderstanding here? And then that's what Dr. Gunn might not be clarified necessary. The proposed rules have a specific standard for the tracks. That standard is basically mostly what's there. These aren't tracks that are being widened and kind of put gravel down, and these aren't milked track type tracks. The standard that's been chosen is basically a standard that most of those tracks up there now meet. They need to be kind of rough walking tracks, not smooth biking tracks. So that's relative to. There's a bit of work in a couple of areas to get into that standard, but not much. And intended that the maintenance costs are low because it's basically what's there. You're walking up the rock of the mountain, kind of.
In many respects, you could almost say that the perception of the user, if the track or trail became too defined, that would be a negative reaction.
Yes. Deliberately intended to be retain that wild walk up Mount Iron kind of track.
Yeah,
just to clarify, a lot of that design work that I was referring to would include things about drainage, places where the trail may have washed out and needing to get the water off the trail.
And in many respects, pushing the biking thing again, you could almost, as in a similar regard, and this is where I appreciate your opinion, that Doc put boardwalks in for the reason being to guide people to that particular track. You could put tracks in that would be walking standard per se, and tracks that potentially could aim to deflect mountain biking to specific areas, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there are places where, like I said, there are a lot of volunteer trails where people have gone wandering in Conica, and those trails probably need to be erased, which is fairly easy to do, it doesn't cost much. So you've got a site hardening effect where the visitors are channeled along a specific pathway. And if you were to add mountain biking to that environment, I would, on the face of it, think that you would put the mountain bikers on different trails. Certainly not the Mount Iron Loop.
In the same way that you could potentially direct climbers to bolt routes on specific parts of the mountain that weren't exposed.
Sure. And with regards to the climbing, it's often found that letting the people who understand that activity the best maintain and manage that activity. So, for example, many places around the world, the climbing clubs now that manage the bolted access that the climbers rely on for their safety. The same thing can be achieved in terms of their environmental impact. And quite frequently, that's about channeling people to particular spaces, but also about them educating themselves and other climbers about their potential impact on that resource.
So, and I know that in Scotland, for example, they have specific areas of mountainside that you're not allowed to bolt route specifically for that very reason. I wonder if you could expand on what you would perceive as being QLDC managing it as a natural reserve. You mentioned that in kind of place.
Having it set ascribed to land managers, it wouldn't really matter who those two landowners, for example, in this case it's Doc and Elton Farms, I think it creates tensions that don't necessarily need to be there. If it was under one landowner, it's a lot simpler to put a management plan into effect. And it seems to me that as I get the sense from Doc, from talking with the rest of the team, that they'd be quite happy to hand it over because it doesn't really suit their mandate. And if that's the case, then it would certainly seem to be council that should be managing that as a reserve through its interest in providing parks and recreation open spaces to its residents, but also as a vehicle for attracting visitors and helping them to enjoy the Wanaka environment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Galloway.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you. Can I just check, Commissioners, that you received the photographs that should have been attached to?
Yes. All good. She did wonder if the house had a building permit.
Just while that's hand there, sorry. We're handing around Mr. White's summary, but before we do Mr. White. I'm calling Mr. Peter Joyce, Commissioners. Wrote an infrastructure report, no issues raised, and the council level of infrastructure. As I said in my submissions, understanding about any concerns in infrastructure, calling him in case you need to ask any questions, and I will ask him just to comment briefly on access by fire engines, if you would.
You read my mind, Mr. Johnson.
Yeah. The fire service water supply controlled by New Zealand Standard, New Zealand Standard 4509, which requires access to a fire engine to 135 metres of any building forest, and the minimum standards that they have in that standard is a 4 metre width carriage way and a maximum gradient of 16%, which is 1 in 6.25. In my instructor report, I've used the New Zealand standard for suburban development, which has a bit of a conflict in that it allows down to 2.5 metres of carriageway width with passing over 25 metres. The area that was shown for the earthworks and removal of Kanuka has been based on a design which had a over 4 metre carriageway width, so it won't offer the extent of earthworks that we've proposed.
Say that again. I missed that, but...
On the plan it shows the extent of Kanuka removal. It's been based on a carriageway access going up to the higher platforms, which is, and then we've done a 4.2 metre wide carriageway, and it's been on a, with 1 metre of berms outside that, so 5.2 total width, and then the bat is heading down to get that total extent of the bridge provided. The reason we did that was to get passing bays in longer, we needed a reasonable width.
And is that adequate for fire trucks?
And that is adequate for fire trucks. It's not the 4 metres wide.
So, do you have permission to share? Commissioner Wright? Why not?
Sorry, yeah, what's that? Following on from the fire trucks matter. I'm minded of a different proposition somewhere else, far, far away from here, that involved similar access considerations. And one of the matters that came up that no one anticipated was that most visitors going to see their friends arrive by car, and most people only provided parking for themselves on their sites, and so visitors parked up on the common access ways. That made it really hard for things like fire trucks to get through because they didn't anticipate people parking all over access ways. Would that be something that would concern you?
The proposed access way standard is 4 metres wide with passing bays at 25 metres. that gets room for a car park to 25 metres all the way up. At 4 metres wide, a standard fire truck's 1.9 metres wide, and a car's 1.8 metres wide. You can get two vehicles past, especially with the berm, you go from the berm and pass under 90% of circumstances.
Would you be expecting streetlights to be installed on an access way of specifications identified?
No, I wouldn't, because it's still decided.
Thank you.
Okay, I actually just agree with the 1700 square metre building platforms, which are much larger than usual, and limited building areas, is quite a bit better than the park.
That's taking the ball that broadly, that'll get you quite a bit.
Well, that's the, that's 400, you've still got 600 square metres to go.
All right, that's a lot of park.
That's a lot of park.
George, I've just got a follow-up to Commissioner Mulroney's questions about access. You might have put it in your statement, apologies if I've overlooked it, but what about the gradient? Are there any areas of access way that might exceed the maximum gradient?
The design of the moment complies with bus gradients. We come to the final design, we'll hopefully we can get a better job with this.
Well, in order to keep to achieve those gradients, what's the requirement way of earthworks? I'm not asking you to sort of respond on a detailed design basis, but is it significant change?
There's no change necessary from those earthworks. They work the way they're shown on the plans that are attached to the what I was saying is that we can improve on those, but we haven't spent a lot of time trying to make the cut and fills less to minimise the extent of the clear. We've put in something that can work, and hopefully the final design will be less than that.
Sure.
Okay.
Commissioner
Mulroney?
Yeah,
it's
all good. All good? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to read quickly, Mr. White.
And I'm going to, as we go through, cut some out for a second. Just to make sure that that's the start started. But just before Mr. White starts, in anticipation of a question about Section 32, that Mr. Mulroney made me think about, and I'm a little puzzled in the sense that Mr. White's primary evidence contains a Section 32 analysis of assessment in terms of the act of what was being proposed in this case. And I'm not quite sure that in this case that's a 32 or 32 AR, but we have that analysis of what has been proposed. I'm not sure we've got to an additional 32AA stage yet.
Yeah, I didn't see the 32 as an attack. I saw an appendix D, which is an assessment against proposed district plans and existing policies. And then there was five paragraphs in the evidence itself giving a Section 32 summary. Is that are we on the same page there, or is there a separate analysis?
We're on the same page, except that the summary kind of summarises the aspects that have been covered in the evidence in front of
it. Yes,
okay. I consider that sustainable management for Mount Iron and for Mount Iron needs an integrated, holistic and enduring solution that provides guaranteed environmental outcomes that protect and enhance the site's ecological, landscape and recreational values in such a way that is economic for the owners and secures recreational and ecological benefits for the wider community and environment. I consider that the planning regime for Mount Iron, as notified in the proposed district plan, does not at least provide for these opportunities. Evidence for LMB proposed a new Mount Iron Park rural lifestyle zone, including a specifically tailored set of objectives, policies and rules with a specific Mount Iron structure plan. A revised Mount Iron structure plan was attached to Mr. Goldsmith's legal submissions. The proposed provisions would be included in Chapter 22, Rural Living, and Chapter 27, Subdivision Development of the proposed district plan.
The proposed design provides for a comprehensively designed rural lifestyle development of 15 houses on 9.7 hectares on the northwestern slopes of Mount Iron, within the existing indigenous vegetation and adjacent to livestock residential activities. Specific objectives and policies are proposed to minimise the removal of existing indigenous vegetation and are directive in maintaining and enhancing the ecological values of Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, not just within the proposed zone area. These objectives and policies are also directive in enhancing permanent public access to Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron through additional recreational trails and integrated recreational management with the adjacent Department of Conservation land. These trails are secured by specific objectives, policies and rules that require the creation of these trails and securing of easements for public recreation use as part of the first subdivision within the zone, along with access or dock to maintain this adjacent land and ongoing maintenance of public trails within the Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron protection areas. In addition, these policies require the implementation of legal mechanisms to ensure the objectives and policies are achieved on an ongoing, permanent basis at no cost to the community. These objectives are specific, prescriptive and provide for secure long-term environmental and public access to the A slightly revised version of design provisions is appended to Mr. Dobson's legal submissions to respond to matters identified in the rebuttal evidence.
At that point, Commissioners, if I can just interrupt. I'm looking through the rest of this page and half the next page, and maybe a summary of effectively a summary of the zone provisions, which I'm sure you're pretty familiar with by now, so if I can ask Mr. White to turn the page and continue reading it. Leave out a certain paragraph of summary and continue reading a paragraph of thing.
These rules are stringent and comprehensive, particularly in relation to the ongoing recreation and cultural obligations for building design controls, especially those applying to building platforms 10 to 12 and keeping of domestic animals. The objectives and policies are also specifically tailored to the outcomes sought in the zone. This is bar statements at paragraphs 12.18 to 12.19 about the level of information provided to support the submission is correct, but this level of information is considered necessary. As a result of site constraints and LMB's development of recreational and ecological aspirations, the rules are more comprehensive than would normally be expected. I have noted Mr. Barr's concerns at paragraph 12.33 about the enforceability of these conditions. These conditions are to be registered on the titles, the properties within the zone, and its consent matters, and so as to be complied with on a continuing basis. This is a standard approach with almost all recent rural subdivisions in the district being subject to consent notice conditions. These conditions are visible on the title to the properties and are therefore known to purchasers at the time they purchase the site. These conditions are monitorable in the same way as other consent conditions and at no more cost. The consent notice will not stop cats entering the site, but it will prevent them from living on the site. If potential purchasers consider the conditions to be too onerous, they can choose not to purchase sites within the zone. Turning to page 5 on ecological. Dr. Lloyd has responded to the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Davis. I have reviewed Mr. Barr's comments, analysis and considered the discussion about the extent of the significant natural area in the 18th C has not been fully cognizant of the proposed zoning controls that protect all indigenous vegetation within the zone outside a building platform and access, and all the Mount Iron protection area and the Little Mount Iron protection area, the planting of revegetation and the eradication of pest plants, animals and the prohibition of livestock grazing from protection areas. I also note proposed controls provide for a higher level of protection than provided for in SNAs and over a larger area. These controls require active ecological management over an area of 92.81 hectares minus the area of building, platform and access in the zone. the notified SNA only provides for passive protection of 48.08 hectares. I also note that this 92.81 hectares, 53.9 hectares will have the additional layer of protection provided by the SNA overlay. Appendix A of the summary includes a revised Kanuka retention and removal plan. This plan has been revised as a result of the changes in the building platform areas described previously. And as shown on this plan, 1.2 hectares of Kanuka, and that's Kanuka that's covered from the areas that existed prior to the recent cleanups, would be required to be removed for the access and building platforms. Half of the area required to provide access into the building platforms will be required and will be replanted in building platform areas, and that's 15 times 400 square metres. That is 0.6 hectares. With the half a hectare revegetation area on Little Mount Island, the net loss of indigenous vegetation from the implementation of the zone is 0.1 hectares. I also note that natural regeneration will be enhanced by pest animal control and the prevention of grazing. For these reasons, I disagree with Mr. Comments with Mr. Barr's paragraph 12.20b and consider that the adverse effects on the ecological values of Mount Iron are sufficiently mitigated at the point set by the proposed controls, including the revised SNA. The proposed mitigation planting, and most significantly by the active ecological management required by the zone provisions. Within the building platforms and accesses, the proposal will not protect indigenous vegetation, but over the remainder of the zone and within the Mount Iron and Mount Iron protection areas, the proposal will better protect areas of significant indigenous vegetation and so better accord with Section 6 of the Act and the regional policy statement than the proposed notified proposed district plan regime. I also maintain my opinion that the required ecological outcomes will achieve and exceed the outcomes sought by the Jefferson policies. This doesn't appear. The proposed zone of Jefferson policies go further than those of the proposed district plan, that they require ongoing action to invite residents of the zone on a permanent basis and without recourse to public funding. Then, preparing my evidence in chief, I overlooked the two following key objectives from the Council's wife reply version to Landscape Chapter 6, and I've quoted objectives 6.36 and 6.37 there, and I consider the proposal to be consistent with those objectives. On recreation, we just heard from Galloway there. Mount Iron receives a high level of use from local residents, regional visitors and tourists as a multiple use recreational area, formalising the existing informal trails on Mount Iron and providing access to Little Mount Iron and commuter trails along the base of Mount Iron will add considerable value to the existing recreational amenities. Now I note on that point that there is no public access at all to Little Mount Iron at the moment. I was surprised that this issue was not covered in detail in Mr. Barr's rebuttal evidence. Dr. Galloway concludes that the developments within the proposed zone will not affect the recreational amenity of Little Mount Iron or Mount Iron. I therefore consider that the proposal will comply with Objective 6.37, which we just talked about, and it will not affect the use and enjoyment of the Mount Iron landscape for recreation and tourism. In relation to the proposed objectives and policies of the zone, I consider these objectives to be specific in that they provide for practical and permanent public access in the zone, the legitimisation of public access to existing informal trails, and provide for these outcomes to be secured by ongoing legal methods. These objectives are an appropriate way of achieving the recreation benefits outlined in Dr. Galloway's evidence and summary. The proposed provisions of the rural or rural lifestyle zone provisions do not provide for such outcomes, and so I consider that the proposed objectives to be more appropriate in these circumstances. I consider the level of recreational benefits provided for by the zone provisions to be significantly positive if they open up areas of Little Mount Iron and Mount Iron for recreational activities that are not currently available. As Dr. Galloway notes, Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron are already used for a range of recreational activities, and the benefits, both social and economic, from increased recreational use are also significantly positive. There are no particular environmental costs associated with the recreation benefits. We will consider that zone provisions will be efficient and effective in achieving the recreation outcomes sought, and that there are no risks or uncertainties about provisions in relation to recreation. On the issue of landscape and location effects, paragraph 3.25 of Ms. Nelson's rebuttal evidence refers to the concept Earth Rex Plan and infrastructure report in order to determine the extent of carbon fill slopes. This plan was prepared to ascertain the extent of earthworks necessary to form the accesses so as to calculate the possible extent of vegetation clearance, and that's the issue that you just had with Mr. Joyce. The maximum height of cut in the accesses is 1.6 metres and the maximum height of fill in that same area is 1.5 metres, whereas Ms. Nelson's conclusion was based on cuts of up to 2.5 metres and fill of up to 2 metres. I also note the report that Mr. Joyce made earlier that the earthworks design at this stage is only conceptual and that the extent of cut and fill may be able to be reduced by design measures such as retaining, but that's at the detailed design stage. In relation to the infrastructure report and council engineering and transport comments note no particular infrastructural or natural hazard constraints that would preclude the proposed development. Specific design of infrastructure can be undertaken at the time of development in accordance with council standards, including a pumped water supply system, with each lot having 20,000 litres of firewood storage. In relation to building restriction area, LMB submission sought that the building restriction area covering an area of 8.6 hectares between the Anderson Road roundabout, the dock car park on the Wanaka Lake Highway, and below the houses on the southern side of Mount Island Drive, the Crocklewood Island, and the Columbia Place be removed, and an 8.9 hectare building restriction area be established on the lower western slopes of Mount Island. I consider the need for the BRA next to the Anderson Road roundabout to have been superseded. The State Highway 6, State Highway 84, and Riverbank Road intersection are welcome to wanting to sign a puzzling world the three parks that are under development on the southern side of State Highway 84 all mean that the perceived entrance to Wanaka is now at the welcome to Wanaka sign south of Mount Iron, and that this perception will be strengthened as the three parks area develops on the southern side of State Highway 84. I believe that the proposed rural zone provisions are adequate to protect the values of this area. I also consider that decision 52A report does not adequately assess the effectiveness of the rural provisions against the BRA and adjustment of the decision 52. In the case of the revised building restriction area, I consider this to be offered by the submitter and provide an additional layer of protection. In relation to fire risk, I've reviewed the Fire Smart Homeowners Manual 2009, and I note that the contents of that document are not requirements, rather they are recommendations to avoid risk to life and protect or reduce damage to property from wildfire. I also note that vegetation control is just one of the recommendations of the Fire Smart Manual, particularly on pages 10 to 14. With the mitigation measures proposed that are suggested on those pages, it is possible to have vegetation close to the dwellings and still be of low fire hazard and risk. In light of this, I consider there are effective fire mitigation measures that are possible to be implemented that do not require vegetation control beyond that provided for in the zone laws. In relation to part two matters in section 32, I've assessed the proposed advanced limits contained in section 5, 6 and 7 in my primary evidence, having now considered the council's rebuttal evidence, my opinion on those matters remains unchanged. The proposal has specifically been developed to manage resources of Mount Iron to specifically protect and actively enhance the ecological and recreational amenities of Mount Iron and within Mount Iron. The ecological management and public access will specifically enable the local community and visitors to provide for their social well-being, while the additional recreational amenities will provide for enhanced economic benefits to the wider area. The proposed ecological management and trail network in the foreseeable means for future generations to be able to access natural areas in close proximity to urban areas and provide a more complete trail network in the long term. The proposal also safeguards the life supporting capacity of ecosystems and avoids unmatched access to the environment. The proposal has also been assessed against provisions of section 52A, which requires identification and assessment of the anticipated benefits, cost and the environmental, economic, social and cultural effects of the proposal. The rezoning will provide benefits in the finding of continuing and guaranteed ecological enhancement and pest control by animal and weed on Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron. The proposal also provides for the provision of additional public access to Mount Iron and Little Mount Iron, which is considered to be of considerable and ongoing benefit, as well as the ongoing track maintenance applied for in the zone. In paragraph 12.19, this is about questions to the cost and effect of this approach. Contrary to the sequence, like the rezoning approach is more efficient and effective than a discretionary activity with this consent. And I note that all the costs of preparation of the rules has been borne by AMRCA, as will the cost of recent consent application to implement that. The ongoing costs associated with ecological management and recreational management will be paid by future residents within the zone. I consider that the zone objectives, policies and methods are more appropriate to achieve sustainable management of the Ellenbeck land resource area than the objectives, policies and methods of the rural zone. The policies and methods have been assessed against the policies of the B to ensure that they are appropriate to achieve the relevant objectives in relation to the Ellenbeck land. I therefore consider that the proposal represents sustainable management of the land resource and achieves the purposes of the Act.
I want to ask any questions.
Mr. White, in terms of the plan behind, can you explain to me the logic of the extent of Kanuka clearance on sites 9, 7 and 9? I can understand all the rest,
mm-hmm.
where you've got to accommodate a house to be placed, but those are existing houses. You already know where they are, you're not going to shift.
I can indeed. The zone provisions do provide the ability for those houses to be extended, and so that the area of connection calculated would be in accordance with the proposed provisions. Whether that happens or not depends on the future owner's development aspirations.
Thank you. Would you like to kick off?
Thank you. So I'll start with section 32 in your reference sheet. To be frank, the release sort is effectively a subzone, a spoke subzone, quite different from the council's notified plan of section 32. In that circumstance, I'd be expecting a submitter to bring their own section 32 with them. And so what I'm going to do is ask you some questions just to try and understand what you've done. So in paragraph 90, you're addressing the limit section 32 relating to objectives. So could you just confirm what alternative objective sets you actually assessed?
In that case, the alternatives were the rural zone.
Yep.
Then the rural residential zone.
Yep.
And rural lifestyle.
Okay, so those are effectively three.
Yep.
All right. And following on from that, I'm not clear on the interrelationship of any between the rural lifestyle general objectives and policies and the specific Mount Iron Park rural lifestyle objectives and policies. So if one was requiring a subdivisional land use consent under the provisions of the MIPRL, let's just call it my purple, because it's like they say, would that assessment be purely limited to the objectives and policies of the MIPRL, or would the more general umbrella lifestyle objectives and policies also be relevant?
I think the existing rural lifestyle provision to update the policy would be relevant and as well as those as proposed.
So, in respect of the three options you identified just before, is it more correct to say the options are rural lifestyle or MyPearl bracket plus rural lifestyle if you've just conceded you'd be relying on those policies and objectives as part of the overall package of provisions?
Yes,
that's
the
one. Okay, so then we go to 91, and then we get to the policies and methods.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm just keen to understand what alternatives you actually considered in concluding that what's actually proposed is the most appropriate. So this is now again, this is now to implement the MyPearl bracket plus RL bracket Austin policy. So having established and satisfied yourself that the MyPearl objectives and policies are the most appropriate, then the second section of section 32 is to assess methods and policies against the preferred objectives. Why would you assess methods of the rural zone against objectives and policies of the zone you've already determined is better than the rural zone? Shouldn't we be talking about the subset of methods that might be available to implement the MyPearl objectives and policies?
Yes, correct.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to understand. What alternative policies, even if you can just give us general directions or concepts that were tested, we know where you've landed, but what else was considered getting? So, for instance, was there a policy that said try and get the council to buy it to establish the Great Park? Mr. Goldsmith told us about this morning.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of argument.
Well, and this has more than just the sake of argument. That has been something that has been quite strongly tested with Calgary and also with conservation. But we have an understanding of councils.
Oh yeah, I'm not asking you to go through and provide that. I'm just asking you to tell me what the options and alternatives you evaluated were, because all your told me is that you did it in your evidence. So was there anything other than that comes to mind?
Those are the obvious ones.
Okay. What I'd like to do now is just... I'll leave for Mr. Goldsmith to think about the question session 32 that lay. And to be frank, as I see it, for us as a panel, if we were to find ourselves drawn to the release sort, we clearly need a convincing rationale in such a decision explaining why it was more appropriate than the alternatives. And I think the evidence we've got that just says it is, I think I'll be certainly comforted by some clearer analysis to that extent. You can think about that and do what you will. So if we go to the objectives and policy, so now I'm talking about attachment, attempted to be.
In that case, would you be able to refer to the latest version attached to Mr. Goldsmith's opening?
Yes, let's do that. Which is, that's fine.
Do you have your hard copy of Mr. Goldsmith's opening? Yes, but I can just
or perhaps hard copy of the zone. Why do you do that? Okay, so if we go to 27.3.17.1. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a neighbour up to 15 rural lifestyle dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
Given that you've put that policy in a subdivision section, is that the right place to put a policy talking about controlling the land use outcome? In theory, one could have a lot that has multiple dwellings on it, or one could have a lot that has no dwellings on it. So how does a policy relating to the maximum number of buildings that are possible sit most appropriately in a subdivision?
If you look at the way the rules have been drafted, it is on the premise that the first development in that zone is a subdivision consent, and that subdivision consent sets in place the building platforms and all the additional controls that go with it.
Yes, but if there are 15 dwellings established in the zone, and I want to come along and get resource consent to put 16 dwellings in, and I'm not proposing a subdivision, how does the council use a policy that says there's 15 max if it's a subdivision policy? Because we all know that there's more to life than one plan change and one resource consent. There's 1-7, there's subsequent purchases, there's subsequent consents, things change over time, and these provisions have to stack up for the period of the plan.
Mm. Is it at this stage worth considering too that in relation to the offer from this morning about the map of the development here in that area?
You're the expert. You tell me what we should be doing. Well, look, I think the way the discussion's gone today, there's a list of things that Mr. Goldsmith and co. Will be thinking about. And so maybe it's just at this point in the afternoon, take the flag. I've got a query about that relationship between subdivision and land use, and it might be that this policy is totally appropriate for subdivision for the stage one, but it might mean there needs to be something similar in the land use section for what happens in the future.
Another thought for Mr. Goldsmith and Ms. Hill from Ponder. In the message I sent through via the Sprintercast, I referred to amendments to chapters that hadn't been mentioned in your submission. It was actually amendments to the subdivision chapter that I was referring to, given that while I listened to your link, Mr. Goldsmith, in the subdivision chapter hearing, this was never mentioned. So I think there's a scope issue that you need to ponder. Not just because I accept that rules might be consequential, but these are objectives and policies going into the subdivision chapter.
Understand your questions.
Back to me. So the objective itself, the last word there, comprehensively planned within a setting of native vegetation. I'm curious whether the subsequent requirements for some exotic vegetation can be justified in light of an objective that only mentions native vegetation.
Can you clarify what exotic vegetation you're...
Well, I suppose you could argue that the list of broadleaves that can be planted around for the fire zone, etc., are all natives as well.
That they are all native species.
Because the gas can only be 1 metre high.
Yeah, I had in my head that we were strictly limiting all planting anywhere to natives.
We're allowing exotics up to 1 metre.
Right. So again, the question. That was my error in the question. So, are you comfortable that an objective that only contemplates native vegetation can support methods that contemplate other than native vegetation, or should the objective say something like predominantly or whatever wiggle room would be necessary to open the loophole?
I'm wondering here about the setting. The setting here is the native vegetation, and any exotic vegetation that's planted limited to a metre in the height is really not going to change the setting.
Okay. 27.3.17.2, ensure that all developments in accordance with the structure plan. Now let's just go to the detail, because the only reference I could find to the structure plan in the rules was a zone-specific standard as a controlled activity. And that was at 27.7.7. Now we've got at 27.7.13.1, 15 building platforms generally as shown on the Mount Iron Park structure plan. And so I just wanted to ask you again whether you're comfortable that a policy that says ensure that development is undertaken in accordance
is being implemented by a controlled activity subdivision rule and a rule that then says located generally as shown on the site plan.
So is your concern with the word generally and there's no specific standard there?
Well, I'm not suggesting I have a concern, I'm suggesting the policy says ensure development happens in accordance with, and the methods might not reflect that. So either the policy maybe should have more wiggle room, or perhaps the methods should have less wiggle room. I'm putting it to you. What do you think there? There's no problem.
Not only
that
they're consistent in the sense that, and I know there's a bit of past experience in this. In fact, this word is taken from a number of other structure plans in our district plan, and well, there's a danger of fixing everything eventually the concrete that the plans
I guess the risk though is that this really sort is a subzone out on its own, and maybe can't rely on the generalities of the rest of the plan because the method is this is better than the rest of the plan. But anyway, I did have, it took me a while, I have to be frank, to get my head through design specific standards, but I got there. I think I understand how that works. Yep. So how do you see the initial subdivision working? So 15 building platforms. It doesn't mean 15 lots, it's just 15 platforms in one lot, two lot, whatever number of lots.
If I can explain, that's to allow flexibility on how many lots you create, but to ensure that the 15 platforms you identify.
Yep. Now, what I then wanted to ask about was the council's reply definition of residential unit. You'll be aware of this from when I asked you about this in the residential hearings. The proposal of the council is now to include the residential flat in the definition of residential unit. And so would that mean that on each of the platform, the one unit per platform would mean one unit plus the ancillary flat that the proposed council definition would provide for?
Correct.
As long as it's all within the overall
The definition of residential unit has always been residential flat.
Well, there used to be rule 4 flat that was removed by the council and put into the definition through the hearing process.
Oh, sorry, and the operative plan.
Yeah, sorry, I'm talking about the proposal.
And the operative plan, for the last each year we've had residential flats.
You're trying to confuse me.
A part of the unit.
I was interested in how we get to the subsequent subdivision. The land may be subdivided in up to 15 lots. Is that 15 residential lots or 15 lots in total? Because it just says the land may be subdivided into up to 15 lots, but if there's a lot that is for a protection area or a lot that's for a common accessway area that doesn't have any houses on it, that might limit the ability to have 15 lots that are actually for housing.
You're right, I hadn't thought about the access
model. So,
it should be 15 residential
lots. Yeah, so maybe you can think about this at the end, that would make that easier.
Yes,
thank you. How did you, Mr. White, get to through the land use rules? This would be the new Table 8. How did you determine which ones should be discretionary and which ones should be non-compliant?
Can I stick my hand up for that, sir, as I wrote that? Non-compliant is based upon height is critical.
Yep.
Discretion is based upon well, it's a maximum ground floor area, and there might be a site where you can come along and say, well, I can have another 20 square metres, it'll make no difference outside the site.
Yeah, okay. I just want to understand the logic.
Yeah.
Thanks. Look, sir, given the latest of the day, I can live with that. I can hold my foot for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Can I take you back to the objectives, or policies, 273.17.1, minimising adverse effects on landscape values. Is that an adequate policy in an ONF setting?
In the course of the case they're making, sir, with the ONF setting including ecological values and recreational values as well as landscape values, and accepting that one set of void, a void means a void, my answer is yes. Not the rationale for it. We can't avoid. And try to minimise, but effectively this case proposes or relies on an acceptance that to achieve the overall outcomes, some adverse effects on landscape values are permissible.
Do you think we should be quantifying the extent of those effects in a policy setting? And he's got to stand on ceremony, whichever one of you is going to give the answer the fastest.
So do you think it should be
quantifying the extent of the adverse effects? Minimising could mean a lot, could mean a little.
You can suggest a way to quantify adverse landscape effects, sir.
That's where the planners are coming. I mean, that's where you throw the hospital pass on our next to you. Well, either way, actually.
I'm quite happy to say I get it. Minimising adverse effects on landscape values, when you're getting into such a subjective judgment where an effect somebody thinks is adverse and somebody thinks isn't, there has to be an area where there is discretion there, and then the rules and methods then try and implement that discretion a bit more, which is what we do with colour controls and height controls and education and so on. I would argue that that's quite permissible in the program.
Can you think of can I just say, I think we need to think further about that. And if the answer is, there is no, this is our case, and that's the end of the line, well, we'll respond to that. Go back to the word generally. I have a different slant on that. Commissioner Monroe was putting to you in terms of implementing policy. In view of the sensitivity of the landscape and Mr. Baxter's evidence about the need for restriction controls, is generally enough? Should it be a tighter control than generally in terms of where the location of the building platforms?
Again, sir, can we take that on board? Because
at this time, we might have a good option.
And just so you understand, the thinking about that was, we've got a structure plan with building platforms of certain shapes and sizes. You may go out there on site and discover that a slightly different shape might be more appropriate. When you come to the detailed design, the only is to just retain a little bit of flexibility around those shapes. But that's generally too broad.
I think you read my mind. No more than minimal change is the sort of language I was thinking of.
Yes.
At the same point about the choice of discretionary as opposed to non-compliant. Building coverage, I can understand, but design standards, again, given the emphasis that Mr. Baxter put on those design standards being critical to ensure this is not a Hidden Hills sticking out in your face on the side of the hillside. I ask you to think about that.
We'll do so, sir.
Fencing, 22.5.46, rabbit proofing if required. Again, given Dr. Lloyd's answer that it is required for all intended regeneration areas.
You said rabbit protection is required, sir.
Yes, well.
I mean, you, I thought.
Is Mr. Clue going to be out there with a shotgun?
No.
those types.
You can predict planting, you can predict against rabbits with a rabbit fence.
Yes.
You can predict against rabbits by putting a little sleeve around each plant that you plant. There's different ways of predicting against rabbits.
It's the if required. I'm not talking about how it's achieved. I'm talking about how vague it's left as to whether it or not it is required.
Would your concern be solved if you just take out the words if required?
Or including rabbit proofing for newly planted regeneration areas, something like that. But like I'm bouncing off Dr. Lloyd's evidence.
Yes.
As I say, could be tyres. As I say, it could be Mr. Clue out there with his shotgun.
But this control relates to fencing.
Well, true. So and if rabbit proofing's not here, then where is it?
Well, the point I was making was that you might want a fence around your building platform boundary, but you might want to have 400 square metres of your planting with little plastic sleeves.
Indeed.
In which case, you don't need to put the rabbit proofing on the fences.
They do. But it needs to go somewhere. Is the point.
Nice.
If it's not there, then where?
Okay, now I was just saying, rabbit proofing of the vegetation is the issue. Right.
Okay. Not fencing everywhere else, because I understand that that's important for landscape protection as well. That you don't have lots of mesh fences.
Some of my questions have already been asked and answered, but I'd just like to go back to the objective that's been discussed previously, 27.3.17, and the policies that follow. I'm aware that the higher order policies and other chapters of the plan deal with ONS, but I just wondered, given that this development is on an ONS, the proposed development, the proposed rural lifestyle zone is on an ONS, not outside it.
Yes.
So I don't see any reference anywhere in that objective or policy to the fact that this landscape in the future is an ONS. And I wondered whether that is necessary. Policy 27.17.1 talks about minimising adverse effects on landscape values. Do you see that that is sufficiently strong to acknowledge Mount Lyon's special qualities as an ONS?
I'm not sure that it's strictly necessary in terms of the structure of the plan, but I see no reason not to include it.
Well, that's why I prefaced it, because I know that ONS are dealt with elsewhere. And similarly, under 27.3.18.1, the references to those undeveloped parts of Mount Lyon which adjoin the zone. My reading of that is that there's almost an inference that the undeveloped parts may not be in the future.
May not be undeveloped.
That may change in the future. So. I put that to you, by referring to undeveloped parts, it actually confuses the issue in a way. Does it? I'm not talking about the values of the...
You are, I understand that.
The values as an ONS, essentially.
Yes, here you've got it, made a
So those are it's more the overall direction of those policies that I was asking you to think about.
Yes, understood that, and I appreciate that. And can I say, it's always helpful with this thing to get a bit of feedback and to and fro, because the provisions always get better.
And for you, Mr. White, bearing in mind Mr. Goldsmith's comments this morning, that this set of provisions that are put forward for us to consider really without any comparable, there's no comparison with anywhere else, but I would like to know from your experience whether this framework, this level, or this type of approach has been adopted in other parts of the plan.
And this plan, this proposed plan,
or in previous plans. I would just like to know from you, Mr. White, whether in your experience this type of approach has been used successfully, whether you have confidence that the level of control that is being recommended will have the outcomes that you say they will.
I'm comfortable that the proposed rules will achieve that, and secondly, in relation to other examples in this area of similar sort of rules, the Opera District Plan has a number of special zones that do cover similar sort of areas, and not in the same complexity, but there is the Three Park Zone and the North Lake Special Zone that adopt a similar sort of approach to this, so it's not unusual in the context of the Opera District Plan.
Well, both of those areas are still under development, so I guess it's a matter of time will tell as to how successful they are ultimately.
Wonder if a better example might be Jack's Point, completed its own ONF or ONL.
I'm not sure Jack's Point's got the same ecological management regime.
True. Not a lot of ecology up there.
Right, well, and finally, Mr. White, I would just like to understand whether you did any of the research into the background to this current rezoning proposal related to the previous subdivisions undertaken by LMB or the VRA issue. I think I understood that you had investigated that yourself, but I wanted to clarify how far you got with any research.
Certainly in relation to the previous subdivision by LMB, that's been working with LMB for, I'm not sure how long, but many, many years on the development of LMB land.
You have, or?
The firm itself.
The firm, yeah.
And I have been since I've been working with the firm.
So you aren't able to shed any light on how the VRA got there, or for that matter, we'll deal with that one first?
I've searched the plans that I've had access to, and they don't give me any appreciation of where that VRA had come from or why it's put in place. I think I understand why it's put in place, but not when or why.
Just going back to the earlier subdivisions, are you able to just help me understand whether reserve contributions would have been under consideration as part of a reasonably large subdivision at the time the LMB land was subdivided?
They certainly were, and if you look into the clues, evidence.
He's referred to the Hidden Hills and creating the dock access easement.
I was going to point out the earlier stages of LMB's development. All include, not all of them, but there are significant areas of parks and reserves that have been invested by LMB.
So those are the smaller
some areas. Some of the more neighbourhood parks and there's a sports field as well that's been provided by LMB to council as developmental financial contributions in previous subdivisions.
Thank you.
Can I confirm legally there are requirements for a land reserve and so on? If this council had those kind of requirements in place, for instance, I can remember.
Yes, I was just wanting to know in what form those conversations have been taken.
In form they have been taken as cash and land.
Commissioner McLeod.
Given that it's the wrong side of 5 o'clock and we've traversed a, and I'm looking forward to Mr. Goldsmith and Ms. Hill's homework, I have no further questions.
I have one follow-up question. We discussed at paragraph 66 the consequence of an RL zone for the O&L, whether it will lose O&L status for that part of zone RL or lose the assessment criteria, depending on the end result of the panel's consideration of submissions on chapter 6. You said that's not a concern to you. My question is, given that we're talking about a bespoke subzone anyway, why don't the subzone of the rural zone? Why not the subzone of the rural zone? Why does it have to be a subzone of the rural lifestyle zone?
Well, the reason was funded out to minimise changes to the district plan. All the general rules of the rural lifestyle zone apply, such as the controls on buildings with builder platforms, which I was going to check and I didn't, but actually they might be permitted up to 500 square metres within the rural lifestyle zone, I'm not sure. But I was involved in that debate, and I just can't remember where it ended up. But a number of the rules of the general rules of the rural lifestyle zone apply in this zone. So we were trying to minimise, actually, despite the 8 pages, minimise changes to the district plan. Whereas if it was to be in the rural zone, it would have to get longer in order to recreate a number of the rural lifestyle zone rules that would otherwise apply.
I suppose this is linked into the concern or the issue that Commissioner Hudson was raising, whether the objectives and policies you're suggesting adequately capture the O&L ONF status.
Yes, and I will look at the N66 to see if there's a significant consequence there.
So the hour is late. There is only one question that I need from you, Goldsmith. Given Commissioner Cloud is waiting with eager anticipation to your further written contribution on a range of subjects now, when are you going to commit to have that quiz?
My thinking, if it would be acceptable to the panel, is that just district plan review deadlines. We're involved in more hearings than for Nazil's here tomorrow. We all have Friday week as our evidence exchange date for all of the Queenstown matter hearings.
So Thursday would be a good option.
So that's Friday the 9th. If you would kind of appreciate having to Friday the 16th.
The answer is the hearing breaks on the evening of the 14th. I'll give you 5 o'clock on the 14th.
Mr. Chairman, I've got one clarification question for Mr. White, Simon. May I ask it?
Yes, certainly.
Mr. White, in paragraph 22 of your summary statement, you then articulated and you said there was no public other access at all to live on Mount Iron. Can I just clarify what you meant by that? Because it did look to me as if there is access through the docks estate and also from the Hidden Hills access. So, Mr. Quinn, are you shaking your head?
There's informal access, but not legal access.
Well, I know
there's
that
certain, you can't
get access. Little Mount Iron is publicly owned land. It's not privately owned land, but anyway, so are you saying there's no right of access as opposed to the kind of legal way of getting to it?
Let me explain both of those. There's no legal public access to it, but there's no legal public access to within Little Mount Iron.
Yes.
There is legal public access that comes to the boundary of Little Mount Iron that can be extended to provide public access to Little Mount Iron.
And there was a fence that people were jumping from time to time.
And you did mention about the fence, but I...
Oh, there's a trail. That trail that goes down to Little Mount Iron that goes along and out onto that road to the beaches. People walk up it, and there was current informal access.
Yes, well, you've clarified it.
Yeah, but there's no legal access.
There's a jumping fence, but even I've attempted another deer fence.
One further thought, clarification. I'm not going to traverse the building inspection area because I don't think we're ever going to agree or come to any conclusion. But you did mention in the evidence you just gave that there was an 8.9 hectare bra was to be established on the western slopes of Mount Iron, mm-hmm. and on the Patterson Pit Bats mats it's 5.5 hectares. Have I? Is that just the wrong figure?
Oh, yes, I suspect it must be just the wrong.
Thank you.
If I can signal, Commissioner, I'm still thinking about it, but I'm planning, I think, to simplify that whole issue by probably withdrawing a request for a separate BRA on the lower slopes, including the building restriction area in the zone provisions and including the covenant you're looking for that says there can be no further building development. And we'll include that area down to the residential zone boundary and separation areas.
Simple as good.
Going to tidy that up.
Simple as good.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask one of your previous questions just to say, I'm going to write it soon. Having thought about it, I do not intend withdrawing the submission relating to ONF boundaries.
I understand. Thank you.
Very simply is because I'm not sure the consequences, I'm not sure where we're going to end up in this hearing until you decide on the environment, but it might be useful. And it may give you some jurisdiction to do something. But having said that, we are not presenting any of this to support that issue. The council has opposed it, and I'm not sure that really creates a practical problem anyway. Because there has to be, in many of the landscape cases, of course, have recognised that there comes a point sometimes where you have to have a practical recognition of realities on the ground. When I think about Round Franklin Arm and Kelvin Heights, the ONF as DFR Heights comes down and just stops. All around Kelvin Heights, the ONF stops at the residential zone down there. And that's ONS and ONLs. So it's kind of a practical planning response to a difficult situation. I'm not going to advocate changing. I'm not going to withdraw.
Thank you. Very understood. On that happy note, I'll adjourn the hearing until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you to the LMB team.